Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with co-host Nicole Nelson. Hey, Nicole.
Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. And our guest today is Constance Hale. Connie is a journalist based in San Francisco, the author of Wired Style and Vex Hex Smash Smooch. I'll get it right one day. Vex Hex Smash Smooch. Her eight-part series on writing a sentence is available at the New York Times Opinionator blog. And she is here today to talk about the reissue of Sin and Syntex, which has been revised and updated and published by Three Rivers Press. Hey, Connie.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
How's it, Nicole?
Hi there.
Good to talk to you again. Let's talk about this revised and updated edition of Sin and Syntex, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. How did this come about? Talk about that.
Well, the original edition was written almost 15 years ago, and two things have happened in the meantime. One, life has changed, news has changed, and as you know, Barbara, I include a lot of pop culture references and political speech and advertising in the book, and it started to feel a little bit dated. I mean, there were a lot of references to Al Gore and George H.W. Bush, for example. I definitely wanted to get some Sarah Palin and Joseph Biden in there. So that was one thing. It just had started to feel dated, and it's funny how language books, you try to write something that will last forever, but language books can become, the more hip or the more you try to reflect the contemporary culture, the more quickly the book starts to feel outdated. That's because language changes so much. So that was one reason to update it, and the other even bigger reason to update it was that as I had been teaching from the book, because I teach a lot of writing workshops, I work with journalists, I edit, I had developed a series of exercises to go along with the chapters. And it's funny because originally I very much didn't want to have exercises in the book because I didn't want it to feel like a textbook. I wanted it to feel like a fun read and something that any writer or struggling student would enjoy reading rather than feeling that it was a chore.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, I thought the exercises were pretty valuable, and I badly wanted to include them in the book. So my publisher agreed to crack each chapter open, and we created a new section which just has a few, you know, one or two grammar exercises and then one or two writing prompts in each chapter. There was one last reason to change the book, and that was that I always hated the subtitle, which I did not write. I came up with Sin and Syntex, but I hated the original subtitle, which was How to Craft Wickedly Effective Prose, because wickedly effective are the kinds of adverbs and adjectives that I rail against in the book. And it was always embarrassing to me that that was the subhead, so I convinced them to let me change the subhead so that it now is How to Craft Wicked Good Prose, which is a lot more Sin and Syntax-y.
Did you create other chapters as well, or is everything here pretty much what was in the first one? Because I didn't compare them, and now looking through them, I'm looking at melody, and I'm thinking, I remember you writing about rhythm, which is a chapter, but did you write about melody too?
Yes, the chapters remain identical, and there's the only difference is there's one chapter whose title I changed. Mm-hmm. So there was, I think in the last edition, it was called Sentence Variety, which is the last of the sentence chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And when I reread the chapter, or reworked the chapter, and partly because of the New York Times series that you mentioned, I thought what this is really about is length and tone, and how by modulating the length of sentences, we can affect tone. And so I just changed that one sentence, that one chapter title. But otherwise, there's a lot of material, new material within the chapters, but the basic structure is the same.
Okay.
This was my first time working with the book, and I actually came at it from a background of theoretical linguistics.
Uh-oh.
So And one of the most interesting distinctions you draw is this one between static and dynamic verbs, which you call the most important distinction between verbs. And at first I thought that was provocative, but I mean, as a writer, I think it's helpful. So, I mean, can you talk a little bit about that distinction?
Thank you. That's exactly how I intended it. It's supposed to be a little, well, let's see, let me, so going back, I'm trying to figure out whether to answer this question backwards or forward. I think I'll answer it backwards. So when I did, I've gotten in a lot of trouble with linguists because ask a linguist what the most important distinction in the verb class is, you know, what's the most important distinction to remember among verbs, and they will tell you that the most important thing to understand is the difference between transitive and intransitive verbs. And in fact, when you open a dictionary and you look up a verb, the first bit of information you'll get about that verb is whether it's transitive or intransitive, and in the dictionary there'll be a little VI if it's intransitive and VT if it's transitive. So there's a couple problems with that. First of all, words like transitive and intransitive give people hives. I mean, it's exactly the kind of language that turns people off to grammar. They can't remember the difference. The words are very abstract. They have no inherent meaning to the person who just comes to a book like mine wanting to understand language a little bit more. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that when it comes to writing, and let me briefly give a grammar lesson, so the difference between transitive and intransitive verbs are that transitive verbs take an object, require an object to sort of complete the idea of the verb, whereas intransitive verbs don't require one. The problem is, first of all, that distinction blurs or doesn't make clear a distinction that is much more important to writers. So if you're trying to write interesting, lively, colorful, dramatic sentences, the most important thing to focus on is your verb, and to use the most interesting, compelling, colorful, dramatic verb you can. The difference between transitive and intransitive tells you nothing in that regard. It does not help you write a better sentence. What helps you write a better sentence is to understand that some verbs, which some people call linking verbs, some people call copulative verbs, some people call passive verbs, I call static verbs. Some verbs are kind of inherently boring. Verbs like is, was, were, are. Or verbs like seems or appears. So certain verbs flatten out a sentence and actually take drama out of a sentence, drain the drama out of a sentence. That's really important to know as a writer, because that is one way you can really perk up your prose, by perking up your verbs and avoiding those verbs. So I felt when I was doing the first edition and when I teach writing, I feel that that's the most important thing to explain to writers. And when I was learning grammar, though, I learned active and passive verbs. The problem is that's a very vague way of referring to verbs, and it leads to some other confusion down the line when you start talking about active and passive voice. Not to get geeky here, but so like, okay, these labels, so that's better than transitive. Okay, we don't want to talk about transitive and intransitive because that's not really that helpful. It confuses people, blah, blah, blah. But active and passive isn't really the right label. And yeah, I could call them linking verbs, but what does that mean? So I decided that the most helpful and the most the terms that would be the most helpful to people, the most understandable, immediately graspable, were static and dynamic, because that really describes the verbs. Some those static verbs describe are used in a situation where we have stasis, where we have no action, no dynamism, and dynamic verbs are obviously dynamic, and it makes it pretty clear why you would want dynamic verbs. Not that you don't sometimes want static verbs, because there are times when you want the nouns and the adjectives to have all the attention in a sentence, in which case, you know, let the verb be kind of quiet and static. So that all made a lot of sense to me, and I realized that I was kind of upsetting the apple cart, but that's never been something that I was afraid to do, so I went ahead and did it. And, oh my gosh, every time a linguist encounters this idea of mine, I get all kinds of trouble. I've had a British linguist, you know, ream me in the, I think it was the London Independent thing. Doesn't she know the differences? She means state of verbs. And she said static. I'm like, no, I didn't mean state of verbs. And then I was actually called an ignoramus on a language blog called Lingua Franca. And, you know, fine, whatever. We differ. We agree to differ.
We've been talking on the show a lot about increasing tension and dread in the plot. And as I was chewing on this idea you had about verbs, I thought that, you know, this is what Connie's asking us to do at the level of the sentence, is just kind of up the ante a little. And so I really... It's a valuable idea, I think.
And, of course, you want to modulate it. So part of the reason to understand the difference between static and dynamic verbs is that you don't want every single sentence to be full of drama and full of tension. We'd all, like, be exhausted after two paragraphs. So it's just something that you want to control and be able to modulate. And there's a wonderful passage from Joan Didion in which she's describing Malibu. It's in the White Album. And, you know, she uses mostly static verbs, and it's because all the energy in the passage is in the noun. So it's the kind of thing where you just want to be aware of it and know what you're doing.
Right. And you also talk about showing versus telling. And you have some useful insight about that, you know, overused advice about show, don't tell. And, in fact, you offer a list of adjectives that should be avoided altogether if you don't want to show. And so, to quote from your book, resist the adjectives of mediocre critics like unforgettable, triumphant, age-old. I just thought that was funny to point out, you know, the culprits.
Yeah. Well, in the... You know, it's the hard thing, or the important thing to remember in writing a book like this for me, is that there are all these bromides. You know, there are all these cliches like show, don't tell, or, you know, avoid passive verbs. Or there are just a lot of things that have been taught over the years, and they had there's a very good reason at the heart of those rules or whatever. The person who first said that had a good idea. But sometimes... First of all, sometimes we all repeat them and we don't really know what it means. Like, show, don't tell, I think a lot of people know that, but they don't really understand what it means because it's just this thing that's tossed out. But also, sometimes it's, you know, I'm hoping that this book is helpful to people who aren't complete beginners and novices at writing, but rather people who have worked at the writing a little bit but want to take things up a notch. And so it's important to try to be a little more nuanced, and I don't know, that's what I try to do.
You know, I am curious about updates, and now we're going to go into like a sidebar on publishing. When you update a book, when you do a new edition, How do advances work?
Yeah, good question, and I'll be totally, totally honest. Much to my publisher's chagrin, I'm sure. First of all, it's really hard to convince a publisher to do an update, because if the book isn't selling well, and you say, oh, but this new edition is going to be so much better and it's going to sell more, why should the publisher believe you? So if the book is, you know, mid-list or just not selling that well, there's really no incentive for a publisher to reinvest in the book because there's no promise that it will do better. If the book is selling well, paradoxically, there's also kind of no incentive for the publisher to do a new edition because it's selling well. The publisher's making money. The publisher doesn't have to invest one more dime to keep collecting the publisher's fee, and as Barbara, you know, and most of your listeners probably know, a writer gets, once a book is sold, you know, over, say, 15,000 copies, the writer gets 15%. So the publisher's getting a much larger percentage than the writer is. So the publisher is making a lot more money than the writer is. So there's not a lot of incentive either way to do a new edition of a book, unless there's some argument that can be made that the new edition is really going to be vastly better and that the market for this book is really going to appreciate and want a new edition. So I actually started pushing for a new edition back in 2009. And the reason I started pushing was that sales of the book started to tick upwards a little bit. And my publisher came back to me, my editor came back to me and said, do you have another language book in you? Because we see that your book is, not only is it a good backlist, but it's actually increasing in sales 10 years after it came out. And that's because the book was starting to be adopted in colleges as a required textbook. Again, irony, because I never intended it to be a textbook, and it's turned out that it's a textbook.
I've recommended it a million times. A million times.
Yeah. So I said, well, rather than my doing an all-new book, why don't I do a new edition of Sin and Syntax? Because I have these great exercises, and if the book is showing some promise as a textbook, why don't we do this? No. I couldn't talk them into it. I ended up, as you know, writing another book, Vex, Hex, Smash, Smooch, which is all about my love affair with verbs, and actually it's really about the history of the English language. And only after Vex, Hex came out, or was in process, was my publisher willing to entertain the idea of a new edition, and that's probably because I changed agents, and I got what's called a power agent, and my power agent put the power in agent, and basically I think browbeat them into doing a new edition. So two things with the new edition. One, and I did a new edition of Wired Style, my first book as well, so the same held true for Wired Style, which is it needs to be 20% new material, and they count. Like, mm-hmm. I had to do everything in track changes so that they could make sure that I was exceeding that threshold of 20%. In order to call it a new edition, that's what they need to do. And then the advance was so low, it was kind of like suicidally depressing. It was, and I'll be totally honest. Can I be totally honest? This is kind of weird, but
yes.
I will be.
Nobody's listening. It's just us.
I got $3,500 as an advance, which you get half of it mm-hmm. up front, mm-hmm. and then you get the second half of it when you deliver the manuscript. I think I got the second half, when I delivered the manuscript. That is so little money, mm-hmm. it makes me cry to think about it. I mean, I worked for 5 straight months full-time to do this new edition. And, of course, I'd collected a lot of stuff already for it. So that's really low wages. And it's a labor of love. And it just goes to show that. Now, I want to say I don't want to make my publisher look bad, because I really appreciated that they wanted to reinvest in Sin and Syntax.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't all about the advance. I had a great editor. I had an awesome copy editor, which copy editing my books is like the job from hell, because everything has to be correct, mm-hmm. or I will get reamed. And then I also, in addition to the copy editor, I had a great production editor, so the person who kind of inputs all the changes and works kind of as a backstop for the copy editor, and he was magnificent. And there were changes in the first pass page proofs and the second pass page proofs, and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to make this guy stay up late at night just to help me with my book, but I haven't found an error in it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And not to mention that they gave it a fabulous cover, and you know, they're helping me promote it. So they have the advance is not the only investment that the publisher is making. In fact, the publisher is really investing a lot in this book, and I really appreciate it. But it's quite hard as the writer, because you have to do a tremendous amount of work. And, you know, you get a dollar a book when you sell a paperback. You,
mm-hmm.
you just don't get that much money when it's in paper. And so, but it's a it's a labor of love. And I believed in the book, and I really wanted to get these exercises out. And I heard yesterday that it's been ordered. I mean, it's like in 340 courses around the country. It's a textbook. So, you know, that's great. And my long-term, I mean, part of the reason I wrote the book is I'm kind of an evangelist, I feel like, sometimes. You know, give me a soapbox and I'll speak the word. I really want to change the way people think about language, the way they think about English, and I really want to give people another way of understanding how to write. And so so it's really thrilling to be able to have this new edition.
Mm. Well, you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM, and we're with Constance Hale and her new revised updated edition of Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose is out. And it's one of the few books on writing or on grammar, style, tone, that I've recommended for years, because I, as well as the information, I love what you're putting forth here, but I love how you write, and that's so much a part, I think, of a writing book or a grammar book is mm-hmm. actually wanting to read the thing, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, regardless of the information.
Yeah, and to jump in there, one of the most valuable points, I think, about the book, because you do, as you say, walk this line between the descriptivist and the prescriptivist, mm-hmm. and you encourage writers to develop and have confidence and, you know, enjoyment of their own idiolect and to use that as their voice. Because in your chapter on voice, which we talk a lot about here, that's mm-hmm. really what you put your finger on, as I understood it, is, you know, making conscious decisions about what you're going to use that's grammatical and what's, you know, ungrammatical in the standard English sense, and mm-hmm. to own that. Is that a correct characterization of your take on voice?
Yeah, and I think voice, I mean, there's a reason that voice comes. Oh, this is another, Barbara, you asked earlier about differences. That was one other change, is I changed the order in the last. So the book is divided into three parts. The first part is called words, and I just march through the parts of speech, the eight parts of speech. The second part is called sentences, and I have four chapters on different elements of sentences. And the last part, which seems strange for a grammar book, is called music. Because the truth is, this isn't a grammar book. It's really a book about good writing, and it just uses grammar as a keyhole or a way into good writing. So the last section is called music, and I did alter the order of the chapters because I realized in the 10, 15 years since I wrote the book originally, to me, voice is a culmination of everything. I mean, voice, and it's, we so often talk about voice with writers. It's something that writers struggle to find their own voice, a voice that's true and authentic, somewhat colloquial, it sounds like them, distinctive. But it's really hard to tell someone how to modulate their voice or how to change their voice or how to affect their voice in writing. And I think really voice is the sum of all of the things that I've talked about before that in the book. So I put voice as the very last chapter. And, you know, voice is partly a matter of just knowing how to put all the pieces in place. So the first two-thirds of the book, you know, is about what are these pieces and how do we put them in place. And then voice is a matter of understanding the music in a sentence and the rhythm of a sentence and controlling the length of sentences. So voice, in my mind, voice is the sum total of everything. It's metaphor, it's the length of your sentence, the particular way you craft a sentence that ends up sounding like you. So I'm not sure if that answers your question directly, Nicole, but that was kind of my thinking behind it. And I think you have to end with voice. You can't start by teaching. In my mind, you know, as a writer, you need to start working on these other things, and voice is the culmination, I think, of a long time, a lot of practice, and a good deal of experimentation. And so you're right, Nicole, I really do encourage writers to experiment a lot, and I think what I try to do, and certainly by having a very playful tone myself, and by breaking some grammatical rules myself in the writing, I'm trying to signal to people that it's okay to play around. And my dream is that I inspire people to go back to the way they thought about language when they were kids. Because if you think about it, when children are learning language, it's a delightful time around age 4 and age 5, because kids are still messing a lot of things up, and they love nonsense, and, you know, we read to kids books like Dr. Seuss that really take liberties with language, and there's a whole delight that a child has in language that's completely beaten out of them by the time they get through the school system. And it's pretty hard to go back to when you're 4 or 5 for a number of reasons, but I'd like to encourage people to go back to that sensibility, that language is a sandbox and we get to play in it.
And on that note, we are going to take a quick break. So all of you out there, stay with us. We'll be right back with more Connie Hale and Sin and Syntax. Don't go anywhere.
baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Molly. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a Bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
The Writers on Writing
every Wednesday morning
at 9 a.m.
with Miss Barbara
and Miss Murray.
Did we say it was Wednesday?
Wednesday
at 9?
Wednesday
in the morning?
Wednesday.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and iTunes, College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with co-host Nicole Nelson, and we have Connie Hale with us. Her book is Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose. Hey there.
Hi. Back.
And you, Connie, we were just talking about the importance of when you're four or five and trying to tap into that state of language acquisition. And you speak in this book a little bit about growing up bilingual. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk to us about your personal experience of being bilingual and how having that, you know, point of comparison helps you as a writer?
Well, I think it allowed me to stay in that 4 to 5 state of mind until I was an adult. But so I grew up, yes, in rural Hawaii, out on the north shore of Oahu, which when I was a kid was the real boonies. And it was a long distance call to Honolulu. And my parents were both educated on the East Coast, went to college. Both my mom and my dad are very articulate and quite nice writers, too. They insisted on proper grammar at the dinner table. I think I was the only kid on the entire island who, when someone called and I answered and they asked if Connie was there, I answered, "This is she." But at the same time, we would go out to play on the beach or in the sugarcane fields, or we would go to school, and everyone spoke Hawaiian Creole, which we called Pidgin English, but the linguists would call it a Creole. And it's a completely bastardized tongue. It mixes. The syntax is somewhat, I think, related to the syntax of the native Hawaiian language, which is a Polynesian language. It's kind of English syntax. They're parts of the syntax from each language. And we throw Hawaiian words, Japanese words, Chinese words, sometimes even Filipino words into the conversation. And so being able to speak Pidgin was very much a part of saying, I'm from here. And I would flip back and forth, as did my brother and my sister. We just flipped back and forth between standard English and Pidgin English. I had an awareness. I mean, there was kind of a double-edged thing to Pidgin. On the one hand, because I'm Haole, I'm white, it was great because it allowed me to say, I'm from here, I'm not a tourist. But it was also, you were a little self-conscious in Pidgin. I mean, you kind of grew up knowing that Pidgin was not as good as standard English. And certainly by the time I went to high school and I went to Punahou in Honolulu, which is the same high school Barack Obama went to, you know, we didn't speak much Pidgin at Punahou, although we did sometimes sit around under the tamarind tree and banter in Pidgin. So, you know, I studied French and Latin in high school, and I think that having flipped back and forth between these two Englishes helped me when I studied other languages. But it was really when I went to Princeton, I majored in English, and I had a moment there when I had an interaction with a professor in which I realized that having grown up speaking a language that depended less on the actual meaning of words and more on rhythm and intonation, because sometimes some sentences in Pidgin are essentially meaningless, and yet they say so much. Like if you say, someone tells you something that you don't know, and you realize that that person is right, you say, oh yeah, no? So it's kind of a nonsense sentence, but I love the way it sounds. And I think that it really sharpened my ear for poetry and for the sound of language. I started as a writer, as a poet. And I have to think that part of the reason I'm so fascinated with the underlying codes of English has to do with this sort of lifelong hearing two Englishes and this question about, was one of them better than the other? Because it was clear that standard English was supposedly better, and yet jokes were funnier when told in Pidgin. Stories were more powerful when told in Pidgin, and I was aware of that as a kid. So that, I think it's just given me a much, much more open approach to non-standard language than most writers and quote-unquote language mavens or grammarians.
Did you ever try to get away from it? You know, like, did you ever go, you know what, I'm going to write like a writer?
Of course, especially because that's what I was encouraged to do. Mm-hmm. I went to a very good traditional high school. We were not allowed to speak in Pidgin or to write in Pidgin, and I, like everyone else, learned that you got more points if you used big dictionary words, and sometimes the only way to a 5-page paper was a lot of padding.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, being a student who wanted to do well, learned some of that and learned a lot of really bad habits, as most of us do. And that's why I was saying earlier, I'm kind of an evangelist for all of us learning how to write in a different way. I think that the way writing is taught in the context of English classes in elementary school and high school and then writing in college is a way that encourages a lot of bad habits in us. And certainly academic writing is, you know, it's so easy to poke fun at academic writing, and it's incredible to me that that's what gets rewarded. Fortunately, I ended up becoming a journalist and having my knuckles wrapped by some pretty gruff city editors, and I learned a new set of habits, and that training in journalism also is part of what goes into my philosophy in Sin and Syntax. And I've thought a lot about how we can teach writing, and as I know you have as well, Barbara, you know, how can we teach writing in such a way that we connect people with the passion of language, because all of us are deep, 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 deep in our core as humans, is this love of language and of expression, and then that frustration of you know, the rules and not understanding the rules, or putting something down on the page and it doesn't, it's not what I intended, it doesn't sound like the way I wanted it to sound. So, you know, I've just tried to think how to help lead people through that thicket and help them come out on the other side.
I'm curious in terms of, you know, I'm still thinking of the third part of your book on music, and and one of the things I like my students to do, and what I probably harangue them over, is to read aloud, to read their stuff aloud at a certain point, maybe not the first draft, but soon, so that, you know, you can hear it, and you can hear where beats are missing, or where there are too many beats, or, you know, it becomes alive and something you can work with off the page. Do you do anything like that?
I don't anymore, because I think once, when you do it, when you make it a part of your writing practice, I think what happens is you develop a very good internal ear, so it gets to the point where you don't have to read it out loud anymore. You kind of, you get that internal ear. But something that I find very useful for my own writing, and also when I teach writing, is to have someone else read my writing out loud and have me listen to it, because I know the way I intend a sentence. And I know the way I think the sentence is going to be enunciated, or in my own inside ear, I hear it a certain way. But it can be quite fruitful to have someone else read your writing, because you hear them stumble in places that you might not stumble if you read it out loud. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, that makes sense, because, yeah, you know how you want it to sound, and even if you're not trying, you're still reading a certain way.
But when you hear the words that someone doesn't know how to pronounce, or you just hear certain infelicities in the prose, so I find that to be very, very useful.
Well, we'd love to hear you read your stuff right now. Could you read just a little bit and give our listeners a taste of the book?
Absolutely. I was debating. We've talked a lot about music. I was going to read the beginning of the music section, but we've talked so much about music, I think I'm going to go to something that's a little more typical, which is what I write about verbs, which are, you know, as I said earlier, just my favorite part of speech. And so I'm reading from the verbs chapter, a section called Make or Break Verbs.
Okay.
The first key to exploiting verbs is to use them. Hang on. And to recast sentences. Some writers devote one entire revision to verbs, circling every is and are, and trying to replace as many as possible. Eventually, dynamic verbs will start flowing from the get-go. But just deleting is and are doesn't suffice. Don't replace static verbs with just any dynamic verb. Be inventive. Verbs like has, does, goes, gets, and puts are all dynamic, but they don't let us envision the action. Why have a character go when he could gamble, shamble, lumber, lurch, sway, swagger, and sashay? Why settle for a verb like says when wail, whisper, and insist are waiting to be heard? Imagine the challenge of writers who cover the races. How can you write about all those horses hustling around a track in a way that makes a single one of them come alive? Laura Hillenbrand in Seabiscuit doesn't have her horse just deliver a winning sprint. Instead, he, quote, slashed into the hole, disappeared behind his two larger opponents, then burst into the lead. Finally, Seabiscuit shook free and hurtled into the home stretch alone as the field fell away behind him. So that gives you a little taste. I mix some examples of my own, a little bit of instruction or pedagogy, if you will, and try to make the examples fun. I try to use a little bit of rhythm or alliteration in my own examples. And then the most wonderful thing about the book, I think, is not my writing, but rather the passages of writing that are sprinkled throughout it. I mean, this book is so fun because I collect all my favorite sentences and paragraphs from years and years and years, and I get to write about them. So, you know, I quote everyone from, well, certainly Shakespeare is in here, but so Shake and Bake. And Joan Didion is in here, and so is Juno Diaz. have some of my favorite ads. Well, you know, it's always tricky, you know, some of these things like adverbs. How am I going to find a passage of writing that illustrates the power of adverbs? You know, how are you going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I remembered that there was this movie, Truly, Madly, Deeply, and that was three adverbs that made the title of the movie. So I have a little snippet of dialogue from that movie to illustrate the use of adverbs. So it's a challenge, you know, to do it, but then I am happy because I think there are so many examples of great writing, and there's something in here for everyone.
And Muhammad Ali.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, he was, you know, probably in some ways, I think of Muhammad Ali and Winston Churchill in the same category, and probably I'm the only one on the planet to put those two rhetoricians together. But the most interesting thing to me about both of them is that we think of them as incredibly poised, articulate speakers. And we think that when Winston Churchill went before the House of Commons, he was speaking extemporaneously. And we think that when Muhammad Ali said things like float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, he just made that up on the spot. But research, you know, has, and good biographies have told us that, I think I read once that Winston Churchill practiced 6 hours for every 1 hour of speaking. And Muhammad Ali, David Remnick's biography of Muhammad Ali, talks about how he would stay up in his hotel room the night before a press conference practicing his raps. So to me, that's so interesting. Even when it's speaking, not actually writing, this idea of working the prose, practicing it, listening for the rhythms, working the rhymes. In the case of Muhammad Ali, his stuff often rhymed in this kind of really crazy way, like, you know, he would say, you know, when asked if he was ready for his fight with George Foreman in 1974, he said, am I ready? I don't have the line memorized, but it's something like, I could injure a stone, hospitalize a brick. I'm so bad, I make medicine sick. just these unexpected. What's so delightful about it's crafted perfectly. Every single part is parallel. I mean, he knew parallel construction, and I doubt he learned it in high school, but he figured it out. And then there are these rhymes that you don't expect. So not only is it rhyming, rhyme really only works in a way when it's surprising, and he's an example of that. So, it's just an example of the different kinds of writing and rhetoric that I try to yoke together in the book.
And I can't resist asking you a wonky but honest question. It's about pronouns. So you go into this distinction in English, or the problem of the gender-neutral third person. And so the quote you give where someone mucks it up is one from Joe Biden at the 2008 Democratic National Convention. And he says, "We were told that anyone can make it if they try." And I'm honestly curious, and since you wrote the original book, have you noticed more of an acceptance of they for the gender-neutral pronoun or not?
I am not a linguist, and so I don't do the kinds of things that linguists do where they count, you know, citations and things like that, but I think for sure they is being used more often as a gender-neutral pronoun and accepted more often. That's what bothers me more. It's being accepted more often as a gender-neutral pronoun. And the reason it bothers me, because I don't really mind, language does change, and I celebrate the change in language. I enjoy the fact that language changes and new words get coined and we use old words in new ways. But when there's a better solution, I do lament the change. So it's so easy in that Joe Biden sentence to use we. Instead of saying anyone, he could just say we. And the problem is solved. So to me, the problem with pronouns is people just don't think it through enough, and it's very easy to recast a sentence so that your pronouns are correct. And I think what happens is when it's a, not to use a terrible cliche, but it is a slippery slope, what happens is we accept that, And it's imprecise. And so what happens is we're accepting a level of imprecision in language. And if anything, I'm a precision Nazi. I mean, that, if you had to take the whole sentence and say, what does she really care about? It's precision. So I regret that change.
Well, if I can split hairs, as someone who also cares about precision, I think something's lost when you make it plural. So your suggestion in the book is all of us can make it if we try.
Mm-hmm.
But he's going for emotional impact. And in that end, you know, I'm an anyone, so anyone can make it if they try. You know, he's talking about me, but all of us can make it if we try. It's sort of diluted. I don't know.
Well, it depends on the tone. I mean, I think, and I go into this a lot. Believe me, I cannot believe how long the pronoun chapter is. It's embarrassing. but pronouns, which seem like the least important word in a sentence, influence so much. So there is this question of precision. But also pronouns influence tone, and pronouns determine, really, this very important thing that writers call point of view. So if I use the I pronoun consistently in a piece that's written in the first-person point of view, and it's narcissistic, potentially. If I use the third person, it's more reportorial and more detached. And so pronouns really have a great effect. I love we. I call it the inclusive we, because I think if you're talking about this kind of collective unconscious, or, you know, the great tapioca pudding that is humankind, we is appropriate. But if, Nicole, as you suggest, you want to appeal to an individual who's listening to you, it's just not that hard to say anyone can do what he or she wants. It's just not that hard to say that. Or sometimes you can just say, sometimes say he, sometimes say she, and nobody will accuse you of being sexist if you do both.
Mm-hmm. So true, yeah. Well, I wish we had more time, and we are at the end of our time. So, in closing, what do you want our listeners to be thinking about as we go off the air?
Well, I just made a joke about my being the precision Nazi, and I would say that one of the things that strikes me most when I'm reading something that seems mediocre is that the writer hasn't taken the time to find the best word. The most precise language. And I said earlier that writing is a practice, and I really do believe that it's a practice like yoga is a practice. And there are a few things that you can do in your practice to up your game, and one of them is to really honestly use a dictionary and a thesaurus and press yourself all the time to find a more precise verb, because that gives your reader a more precise image. It's such a favor to your reader to be precise. And then, obviously, choose your verbs carefully. That would be another thing. And then, I think, you know, this idea of reading stuff out loud or having other people read stuff out loud, pay attention to the music of your own words. It can be musical. Not just, the point isn't to be correct grammatically. The point is to make a little music in our sentences.
Hmm. Yeah, and that precision, as you said, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot more work to do it. And you know, just real quickly about pronouns, it's probably one of my pet peeves in, you know, in talking even or reading, and it's like, well, are they talking about this person or that person? Who are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Just use a name.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Thank you so much for being with us.
And, oh, it's been great talking to you guys. Thanks.
Yeah, it's been great to have you. Thanks, Connie. That was Connie Hale. Her book is Sin and Syntax, How to Craft Wicked Good Prose, and it's published by Three Rivers Press. And, yeah, it's a book I have recommended for years and years. I probably harangued you with the book, didn't I?
Sure, it came up.
I mean, ever since I started, like, doing anything with workshops, this is one of those books. And I'm sure I am part of the reason why there was an uptick in sales in 2009. I was teaching a lot then. Anyway. So, Nicole.
Barbara?
Yeah. you know, we have a minute left, and I brought along Elmore Leonard's 10 Rules of Writing, and he passed on yesterday, and I have the illustrated edition that Andy Mitchell drew a illustration in the front of, because it was a gift at one of the workshops a few years ago that I actually received. And so there's illustrations by Joe Cherardiello, and it's Elmore Leonard's 10 Rules of Writing. And every so often I open it up and I read, and what did I... Oh, of course, keep your exclamation points under control. And then he says, you're allowed no more than two or three per 100,000 words of prose. If you have the knack of playing with exclaimers the way Tom Wolfe does, you can throw them in by the handful. And there was something else back here, which, you know, I mean, some of the things I go, well, okay, maybe, maybe not. But he says, rule number 9, don't go into great detail describing places and things. Unless you're Margaret Atwood and can paint scenes with language or write landscapes in the style of Jim Harrison. But even if you're good at it, you don't want descriptions that bring the action and flow of the story to a standstill. Yeah, yeah, yeah. True, true. And I'll leave you with this one. Rule number 10, try to leave out the part that readers tend to skip. And he says, A rule that came to mind in 1983 at lunch with Book of the Month Club editors. Think of what you skip reading a novel. Thick paragraphs of prose you can see have too many words in them. This is a good little book. I'm going to read the whole thing again. Anyway, thank you for being here, Nicole, and all of you.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks to you, Barbara.
Everyone out there, thanks for listening. Connie Hale's website is sinandsyntax.com. And there's all kinds of stuff there. She has things on there for instructors as well. I wrote it down somewhere. Now I don't know where. Oh, a lesson plan on her website, which is a really cool thing. And she, if you go to the New York Times and if you subscribe, I believe you have to subscribe to find her opinionator columns. I think it's called Draft, and then look for her name, Constance Hale. And there's all of her columns that she wrote about writing. Anyway, we have to go again. Thanks for being here. Come back next week. And until then, stay in the chair.